Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Gardeners, this is that time when all your hard work is literally coming to fruition. Flowers in bloom, veggies growing and ripening, trees and shrubs looking so lush. It is a time when gardening could be your full-time job. Take off for a long weekend to the Cape and you return to a two-ton zucchini residing in your vegetable patch. The weeds that you thought you'd get to by now have enveloped your garden. And what in the world are those creatures munching on your plants? Ah, they're tomato hornworms. Don't despair. Horticulturist Charlie Nardozzi is here with advice and the answers to your summer gardening questions. Charlie is the host of VPR's Vermont Garden Journal. Charlie, great to have you back to save the day and some gardens.
Well, we'll see what I can do for you.
All right, Charlie. So one thing people can do right now is harvest early. So how do you know when to do this and when it's not too early to harvest something?
It's almost never too early to harvest certain things. So one of the problems we get, just like you were talking about, Rick, is that you get these zucchinis that just seem overnight to be go from a little 3-4 inch size fruit to something that you're going to hit over the over the head
truncheon.
With. Exactly. So what I've been doing more and more over the years is that I've been picking things at a smaller and smaller stage. So for example, zucchini, summer squash, any of those summer fruits, pick them when the flowers are still attached. So after the flowers open, they usually open just for a day, and they'll usually open in the morning, actually, just for a day. And then they close, then you can just pick those fruits. That accomplishes a couple things. First of all, you don't have these huge blockbuster vegetables that you have to harvest and just figure out what to do with afterwards.
Which aren't as good as when they are smaller.
And that's the other thing with it too. The smaller ones are tastier. They're tender. They're easier. The skin is softer. Yeah. They're easy just to chop up and saute. And most of us don't need a huge zucchini to eat. I mean, who's going to eat all of that, really?
Right.
So if you can stay on top of those kinds of harvests early in the season, I've found that even if you have 5 or 6 or 7 of those small ones, you can make a meal out of that. If you had 5 or 6 or 7 of those huge big ones, you're not going to know what to do with them, and you end up putting them in your neighbor's car and mailbox and things like
that. Exactly what you do. They get kind of woody. I think I've seen Big Poppy back in the day actually use one.
I think he used one, yeah. 450-foot home run,
that's
I think
right,
it was.
Right?
So not only just with zucchini and summer squash, it's the same as true for cucumbers is another one's like that. Beans is another one you want to pick on the young side. So there are some plants, though, that you don't obviously want to do that. Peppers and tomatoes and melons, they have to reach a certain peak of ripeness for you to actually pick them. But for some of those other ones, picking early and often is a good idea.
All right, got it. So the early harvest is a good way to go. Let's talk a little bit about watering. How has the season been for getting ample rain for plants?
Not so good.
No.
It's been very spotty. So if you've been in a place where you've had some summer thunderstorms that have come through and have really moistened the soil, that's great. But in most cases around the state, it's been pretty dry. And it's been hot and dry. And it's been hot and windy and dry,
yeah.
Which are really not great combinations for vegetables, for example, for annual flowers, for perennial flowers, and for newly planted trees and shrubs. So when we're talking about watering, there's different techniques you're going to use for different plants depending upon what it is you're watering. So if you're trying to water new seedlings, and we'll talk more about planting seedlings now for the fall, you're going to want to water early almost every day, sometimes twice a day, depending upon the weather. So to make sure that the soil, a couple top inches of the soil stays nice and moist, because that's where the seedlings are going to grow from and germinate from. If you're talking about watering something that's established, like a perennial flower or a tree and a shrub, those you want to water deeply and infrequently. Mm. So you want to go out there maybe a couple times, 2-3 times a week, and water it so that it soaks down a good 8 to 10 inches into the soil. And that may mean just standing there with your watering wand and counting to 30. 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. But the idea
I think can count to 30, but he's just going to cut it off right there for you.
I wanted to give you the pace.
Thanks.
The pace of it. So that would give you an idea that after about 30, you're going to have put enough water on there that you've really soaked it down. And that's important because the root ball needs to have that moisture in there so that the roots can not only survive in the root ball, but expand out into the native soil too. So watering deeply and infrequently is how you should have been watering those perennials, trees, and shrubs that are out there.
Well, does mold mulching kind of help in that? Does it like help shield the soil from the sun and reduce maybe evaporation?
Right. So mulching would be a great thing to do with any of these perennials. And putting down a bark mulch, some straw, some hay if you don't have straw. You know, of course, hay has some wheat seeds in it, but it's still a good thing to use. Chopped up leaves, pine straw, which is pine needles basically. You can put all of that around a tree or a shrub in the soil and keep the soil not only moist but cooler too, because these hot temperatures are not great for roots for a lot of plants because they're not going to grow very well when the soil gets too warm. So if you can keep the soil cool and moist, that's going to be the ideal conditions.
And we did get this email from Jane in Moncton. And she says she's a longtime host, first time emailer.
This is not the Jane.
Yes, it is. She can't host today, but she always has questions about her gardens, and today it's about the lawn. So she says, Charlie, over the years, we've done garden shows together, and I think you've come to know that I am what could be generously called a lazy landscaper. But I realize I need to do something about my lawn. In the previous heat wave, a lot of the grass on our lawn has died. We have big brown patches all over the place. I'm hoping you can offer a cost-effective, and here's the key term, minimal labor approach to making our lawn the best it can be for next year at least. We have about 2 acres. I don't use chemicals on it because, as I said, I take a laissez-faire approach to gardening, but I'm open to all suggestions.
Well, first of all, Jane, why didn't you call? We can talk about this.
That's right. You know the number, Jane.
You know the number. Exactly. So talking about lawns in this hot, dry conditions that we've had this summer, you'll see a lot of lawns have gone brown. And in fact, that is a defense mechanism that the lawn will do when it gets hot and dry. It's a drought response from the lawn. It just basically shuts everything down. The grass is not dead. It's just gone dormant. So I grew up in Connecticut, and we saw these kind of conditions are what I used to live through all the time in Connecticut as a young man and a boy. And we would always see the grasses on different lawns going brown. Now, it all depended upon the kind of grass that you had and who was watering it. If you're trying to stay on top of the watering but putting sprinklers on it, that kind of thing, then you can keep it green. But to worry about it just because it turned brown, I wouldn't be too concerned about it. It will bounce back.
So Jane can do nothing.
Exactly
what she loves
she
to do.
She could do,
with this
have
landscape.
The perfect solution for Jane, which is nothing at all, and it will be green again probably come fall.
Did she tell you to say that?
No,
did she get you to say that? That's unbelievable.
But I could add a few other little caveats for Jane.
I want you to.
So a few other things you can do. Obviously, if you have healthy soil and thick, rich soil, the grass is going to stay greener longer and grow better. So by adding compost to the soil, and this could be done on a rotational basis over the number of years, just putting like a half-inch thick layer of top dressing of compost in the fall on the soil, that's all you need to do. Maybe overseeding bare spots or thin spots in your lawn with some more grass seed with the compost, that's another nice combination. If you have a thick lawn that has a deep root system, it's going to withstand the hot, dry temperatures better than one that's shallow and just, well, laissez-faire.
So yeah, in terms of like hours, how much would she have to put into doing a few of these things you're suggesting?
Well, 2 acres, she'd have to find another job, I think. But that's why I suggest people do it in areas or patches. So all you need to do is get someone to deliver some compost, and then you need a little time to like rake it, spread it out a little bit, and then throw the seed on it. So how old are her kids? No, they're not old enough.
They're not.
Okay,
I can't wait for the fall gardening show when she actually admits what she how she
I'm sure she did the first thing I suggested.
All right, let's take a couple questions we have here from Mike. First of all, he posted this: is there any control against tomato or potato blight? I understand it's airborne. It attacks our plants every year, ruining the plant and fruit. Makes no difference where we plant, pots above or in the soil or directly in the soil. Is there any control or remedy?
So yes, blights, tomato blight that goes on potatoes too because they're in the same family. There are a number of different kinds of foliar diseases that will attack tomatoes and potatoes. The one that we have the most concern about is late blight, which I have not heard of any outbreaks of in the state this year. This has not been a bad year for blight, at least in the gardens I've seen in my own personal garden. I think because of the hot, dry conditions, it just hasn't lent itself to the blight fungus really getting started. So the late blight is one that if it happens on your potatoes or your tomatoes, you need to rip out the plants and just get rid of them. There's no really way to control that. But most other people are getting early blight, septorial leaf spot, bacterial speck. There's a number of different kinds of foliar diseases. And they're all related to weather conditions. If you have cool, rainy weather, you're going to see a lot more of that than the hot, dry weather like we had here. There are resistant varieties of tomatoes that are out there, and maybe even some potatoes, but I'm not exactly sure about that, that you can try, you know, that will be less likely to get these diseases. And they're nice tomatoes, everything from Mountain Magic, which is a small cherry tomato, up to some larger ones like Defiant, for example. There's a number of different varieties.
Nothing messes with the Defiant tomato.
It's a Defiant tomato. Getting a variety that will be resistant to these, or at least more tolerant of these, would be a good idea. And then the list of other preventive mechanisms, like picking off leaves when you start seeing signs of the blight, putting down some kind of covering over the soil, mulch of some type, so the spores that are normally are in the soil, when it rains, they don't splash up onto the leaves and get started. I tried a spray this year, and I can't really say it made a difference or not, because this year has not been a bad blight year, but it's called Actinivate. Actinivate, and it's a bacteria that I spray on the soil around the plants and on the bottom leaves. And supposedly, this bacteria will fight other kinds of microorganisms like fungus. So I did that fairly religiously for the first month or two before our plants got so huge it didn't really matter anymore. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get any blight on them. So again, though, I'm not sure if it's weather conditions or that product.
And you said removing the leaves when you see the blight on it. So what does that look like?
The blight itself?
Yeah.
It depends upon the kind of blight. You get the septorial leaf spot that looks like almost like a bullseye spot. Mm-hmm. The early blight looks like these little yellow spots on the leaves. So if your leaves are getting lots of spots on them, and especially if they're getting spots and turning yellow, then take off not just the leaf, but that whole stem back to the main trunk of the plant. And look above it too, because chances are the leaves above it probably have the early signs of that disease.
Now we have another potato question and another question from a person from VPR. So
maybe this is just the in-house show.
Yeah, could be. Anna St. Marie says, I'm growing potatoes for the first time, and I'm worried that I haven't been earthing them up properly. There's probably about a 2.5 feet of the plant visible above ground, but I've read that they should be only about 6 to 10 inches of plant visible. They're growing so fast, I just can't keep up. Do you think my tubers were exposed to sunlight and are poisonous now? If so, would you recommend I dig them up and try to plant something else in their place, like spinach or arugula, that can grow well into the fall? Or is there another veggie that does particularly well when planted in succession with potatoes for the remainder of the season?
Okay. Well, let's take a deep breath.
Yes,
and just back away from the potatoes for a moment. So first of all, if you hill them up, usually you have to hill them up twice, or earth them up. I like that. It's a nicer expression than hill them up. You would do that twice during the growing season. So when they first pop out of the ground, bury them. Literally hill them or earth them so that you don't even see the tops anymore. Then let them poke through again and do the same thing maybe a week or two later. Then that's usually enough. You don't have to keep doing that during the growing season. So the information she had about they need to only have a couple inches, I think it was.
Six inches or ten inches
above the soil line all the time. That's not really that true. Really, you just want to have a nice mound of soil underneath the plant. And what that mound of soil is doing is allowing those modified stems to form tubers. And the more modified stems you have in that soil mound, the more tubers you get, and they're protected from the sun. So as long as she doesn't have any tubers that are exposed to the sun, they won't turn green. So if she sees some that have exposure to the sun, you can cover them with mulch, you can cover them with more soil, just cover them up, and they'll be okay.
All right.
Yeah, so she doesn't have to worry.
Wow.
As soon as those vines start dying back, that's when she can start harvesting. Or she can just leave them there and harvest whenever she likes, when it's cooler maybe.
Well, we're going to get to pests next, so let's take a break now, because we're going to open the door to pests in a few minutes, Charlie.
Okay.
Get you fired up for that. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. Gardeners, put down the hoes or gardening shears for about a half hour, because we've got someone who can help with whatever conundrum your vegetable plot or flower bed has been presenting this summer. Master Gardener Charlie Nardozzi is with us today. He's the host of VPR's Vermont Garden Journal. Now, Charlie, you go globetrotting with these garden tours, and you are going to do one next year in Cuba.
Yes.
So have you visited Cuba before?
Nope, I've never been before. And we made some connections and were able to set up this garden, culture, and history tour of Cuba next March. So it's March 20th to the 27th. So it's about an eight-day trip. And it's going to be fun because it's a combination of things. Certainly, we're going to go down there and we're going to see Cuban gardens and Cuban farms, the organoponicos, if you know anything about the agriculture down in Cuba. So the urban farms that were set up when the Soviets pulled out back in the 90s so that people could feed themselves. We'll see an example of an urban one and a rural one. We'll go to an orchid botanic garden. We'll go to a botanic garden that has a relationship with Harvard University. And then we'll see historic and cultural sites all around the island as well. So we'll be based in Havana for the first four or so days. And then we'll jump on the bus and head south. We'll go down to the south coast to Trinidad and Cienfuegos and be down there for three or four days as well. So it's going to be a real fun trip. And as you know, with Cuba, there's more travel restrictions now than there used to be on them. So to go as a group, you need to have a special visa, and we handle all of that. We've partnered with a group out of Seattle who's done over 10 different garden tours to Cuba, so they've got it all worked out. There'll be a local guide that will be with us the whole time who's knowledgeable about gardens and the culture and everything. And there'll be time to listen to music and to dance in the streets and to see the art and just all that fun stuff that's all part of the Cuban culture.
And you'll all be flying together out of somewhere in the U.S.?
Well, we'll all meet in Havana, but we can help with travel arrangements, too. You know, some people will be coming from Vermont, other people from different parts of the country. But the tour does start in Havana, and that's where we'll meet up with everyone. We'll be staying at the Hotel Nacional, which is the famous hotel that back in the 40s and 50s was where all the movie stars went. My parents actually honeymooned in 1947 Havana.
Oh,
so
Charlie,
it's
going
to be kind of
wonderful.
Fun for me to be there. Yeah, so we opened it up about a month or so ago. We got a great response. We do have some spaces left, but it is filling up quickly. So if you are interested, certainly go to my website, gardeningwithcharlie.com. Just look for tours and you'll see the 2019 Cuban tour. And if you have questions, of course, you can just email me too about that.
All right. And we also have a link to your website at vpr.net/Vermont Edition on today's show page. So you can find it that way as well. All right, Charlie, it's time to take some calls. We're going to go to Linda from Wolcott. Linda, you got a pest problem.
Hi, Charlie.
Hi.
I noticed recently that I had this huge outbreak of aphids all over my peas. I mean, everywhere. So I'm not quite sure what to do. I ripped them out yesterday, all my peas, and dumped them someplace not near my compost or anything. But I don't know what else I need to do to have them not go on to my beans and everything.
Yeah, so
stomp the ground. And
you can threaten them, Linda. That's what you can do. So the peas are a very attractive plant for aphids. They love the young, succulent growth. And in fact, if you watch where aphids normally feed, whether it be on a tree, a shrub, a vegetable, a flower, it's often on those young flowers or young leaves that are coming out. So one thing you can do if you do see more aphids on beans or any other plants is to take a hose with a nozzle on it and just literally blow or wash off all of those aphids off the plant. Once you've knocked them off the plant, chances are they're not going to crawl back up again. So that's a really safe, easy, environmentally friendly way to knock those aphids off so that they don't cause any damage. As far as going into the future, the best thing to do is to stay on top of it. So next plants, when you do peas again, either this fall or next spring, just watch at early stages. Whenever you see the aphids there, just jump right in with your controls and don't let them get so established that you have them all over the place. That's when they really cause damage.
And once you knock them off, is that when you should start stomping the ground?
That's when you start stomping the ground, exactly.
All right, let's talk to Joanne, who's calling us from Waitsfield. Hi, Joanne. Go right ahead.
Hi, yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have, I'm not sure I can quite call it a pest, but I know how much we need them in the garden. They're a set of ground bees that I have tried to get rid of unsuccessfully. They've stung my daughter, they've stung me twice, and I'm wondering how I can either remove the nest or remove the bees without using any pesticides and still preserving the garden.
Excellent. Thanks, Joanne. Let's also talk to Leah, who's calling from Waltham. Hi, Leah. What's your problem?
Hi. Yes, I've had a similar problem to the ground bees. I have yellow jackets, and they're nesting inside the walls of my chicken coop. They've gotten pretty aggressive, and I can't even deal with it without getting stung. I've been stung twice this last week, so I know it's kind of late in the season for them, but I didn't know what I could do about them.
All right. Okay, so we have ground bees and we have yellow jackets.
Yes, we do.
So for the ground bees, yes, there are many of the pollinating insects, the solitary bees that are out there, are individual bees that live in the ground. In fact, there's more of those out there pollinating our plants than the honeybee, who gets all the attention.
Yeah.
And the bumblebees. So trying to not harm those is a good idea. But that being said, if they're stinging yourself and your daughter, you don't want to have that in your garden. That takes the joy out of gardening. So what you can do with both that and the yellow jackets for the ground bees, you could try to flush it with water, and that might drive them out. Just if you get water into their chambers where they are, that might drive them out and they would go somewhere else. Some people have had success with repellents using things like essential oils, using mint around them. Cinnamon is another thing, and orange peels. And this would work for the yellow jackets as well. They all have strong smells to them, strong fragrances, which will be things that they don't necessarily like. So for the yellow jackets in the chicken coop, you might want to put those in there, see if that makes a difference on those. And the same thing with the ground bees.
All right, Charlie, we got a ton of pests, so I'm going to keep going with
them. Okay, go with the pests.
Here's what Bobby posted. I assume because I've tried everything, even nasty insecticide, that I am soundly defeated by Japanese beetles, and I will never get a rose blossom before they do.
I know the feeling. Because as soon as your roses start blooming, as soon as they hit peak bloom, that's when the Japanese beetles tend to come out, late June, early July, and then they just devastate them. So I can do a quick Japanese beetle 101 for you. So first of all, the weak link in the life cycle of a Japanese beetle is the larval stage, which is the one that's in the soil. That's a little C-shaped grub, white or yellow C-shaped grub that lives in the soil. So that grub will, right now, it's they're laying eggs in the soil. We're around where they're feeding, by the way. They don't go all over the place to lay the eggs. They tend to just drop to the soil and lay the eggs there. And those eggs are hatching into those C-shaped grubs that will then continue to just kind of live in the soil until it starts getting cold. And then they'll tunnel deeper into the soil. So the time to control the grubs is in September, late August, early September, with some kind of material, or in the spring when they come back up again, like in May and June, before they start pupating and turning into adults. So I've used beneficial nematodes.
Yes, I knew they'd make an appearance today.
They always do, don't they? Pretty successfully to not eliminate them totally, but knock down the population. So the time to do it again would be June or early September. You spray the nematodes in those areas, lawn grass areas or areas that are not disturbed, because that's where they lay their eggs. You'll do that and then water them in really well, especially in these hot, dry conditions. You might have to water them for a number of days every day in that area so that those nematodes will stay alive. They'll use the water channels to find the grubs and parasitize them. So that would be probably the big line of defense, is to do that first. You can try the Japanese beetle traps. They do work. You just have to make sure you don't put them close to your plants. Put them a couple hundred feet away from your plants and only a couple feet tall, because that's where the cruising altitude of the Japanese beetle is. And so they hit the trap before they hit your plants. I so often see people putting the traps right next to the tree, like the crab apple tree, or right next to their vegetable garden or grapes or whatever. And all it's doing is attracting more Japanese beetles to your plants.
Ooh, no bueno.
So that would work well for that as well. During these hot, dry conditions, one of the nice things about this summer is that we're not going to have as many Japanese beetles next year, because they're not going to be able to, the eggs and the larvae will not be able to survive these hot, dry conditions. So you might be off the hook next year, and I'd say go for the roses.
Sounds good. All right, Bobby, you got that. Next pest, leek moths. MK in Waterbury emailed, our 20-plus year garlic crop has finally been attacked by a pest. Our research shows it to be leek moths. We cut away visible damage in moths earlier in the summer and have now harvested our crop. We've thrown away the leaves and are wondering if we can hope to replant in the fall or if we need to give up our garlic addiction for a few years.
No, you can actually grow garlic without too much of a problem with the leek moth. The leek moth, for those who are not familiar with it, is a new pest. There's always something new out there. And
it's fresh.
It goes after the alliums, which you thought were a group of vegetables that tended not to have a lot of pests. myths, which was true, the garlic, onions, and leeks in particular. It's a moth, so it's a night-flying insect that lays the eggs, and it has a couple different generations in the summer. So the early ones will go after garlic because those are coming up early, and it lays the eggs on the plant, and then the egg hatches into a little caterpillar that tunnels down into it. So I haven't seen that much damage on the garlic to be too concerned about it, but what you can do, a very simple thing to do, not only with the garlic but your leeks as they're growing and your onions, is to cover them because these plants don't need any kind of cross-pollination from bees. So if you cover them with a material so that they can't lay the egg, you don't get the damage. And this is particularly important for leeks because leeks are a very long season, and they're the ones that I've seen get decimated from the leek moth because the population builds over the summer. You get the second and third generation, and by then they're just feasting on your leeks. So you can cover them with a lightweight floating row cover. That works well. Or I've even used tulle. Now, do you remember tulle?
Yes.
The days when you used to have tutus and
yes,
wedding veils?
All those things. I was going to say, I believe my wedding dress was – we used some tulle on that. Yes.
So tulle is a very lightweight material. It's kind of like a window screening but very flexible and lightweight. It works really well to keep insect pests from laying eggs. So you can get some at a fabric store, lay it over the plants, maybe over some hoops on the plants, anchor it down with some stones or boards, and just grow your plant to maturity underneath that tulle or the floating row cover, and you won't get the pest.
All right. Let's keep the pest hotline going. We have Amy calling from Bennington. Amy, what's bothering you today?
Hi. Yes, I have something that is digging up my front lawn. It's full of little holes, and it's all dug up.
Wow. Amy, Charlie might want to ask you some questions about that, but before we get to that, I'm going to also read what David wrote. He said, voles have decimated my mature asparagus patch, and they are munching on my potatoes and beets. What can I do? So from below, we've got some things happening.
We've got problems
here.
Below. So
yes, we do.
First of all, Amy, you have these little holes in your lawn. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But it doesn't look like somebody dug up the lawn, like a skunk, for example.
It could be a skunk, perhaps,
yeah.
But I'm thinking, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a possibility because the skunks are going after the pest that I just mentioned, the Japanese beetle grubs. And there's a lot of other kinds of grubs, but that's one of the ones they like. So they'll go into your lawn, and if you have those grubs in your soil, they're digging around looking for them as a food source. So in one way, they're actually making it a little easier for you to grow gardens. But of course, they're ruining your lawn in the process. So the solution is obviously take away the food source. So if you can spray those beneficial nematodes on that lawn, probably again late August, early September, that'll reduce the population of grubs. And so then those skunks will go elsewhere for their meal.
Wow. All right. Now the voles.
Oh, yes. The voles. Voles and the asparagus and potatoes and beets. Yeah, that's a bit of a problem because voles will go in not only using their own tunnels, but mole tunnels. Moles will not attack your plants. Moles are really looking – they're carnivores. They're looking for earthworms and beetles and things like that to eat. But the voles will. But they'll use the mole tunnels to get to your plants and then, of course, cause all kinds of problems. Every year I grow sweet potatoes, and every year I get some of those sweet potato tubers are munched away by voles and mice that are out there. So it's not an easy thing to really remedy. You can try some of these repellent things. Some people put hot pepper flakes down. And again, I mentioned some of those essential oils. They may or may not work. But if you run a real fail-safe way to grow potatoes or have beets or keeping these voles out, it's probably best to use some kind of wire that would be underneath a raised bed or around the raised bed so that they can't get in from below. That's usually how they're getting in. They're not necessarily going to come on the soil surface and climb in because that exposes them to predators too much, but they're tunneling in below. So depending upon how big your asparagus patch is, that would be one solution is to actually put down some wiring underneath it or around it just to discourage them enough so that they don't start tunneling.
And we could go back to that earlier suggestion of stomping the ground or maybe negotiating nicely.
Stomping the ground, having a good cat around or a good dog around. Sometimes we'll keep them away too.
All right, Charlie, one more pest question. This one from Nancy who writes, do you have any recommendations for keeping chipmunks out of the vegetable garden? The garden has deer netting around it, but they find ways in. I've tried repel spray, a fake owl with a motion detector, an onion, garlic, hot pepper spray I made, and yelling in frustration all to no avail.
The yelling in frustration. I've been there. I know that one. Yeah, you've hit all of the things you can try with chipmunks. Chipmunks are tough because they're small little rodents and they can squeeze in between the spaces in netting. They can tunnel. They can climb. They can do all the things they need to do. So if you have a lot of them there and they're going after certain plants, especially when it's really hot and dry, you might see them going after fruits like tomatoes and melons because they're looking for the moisture. It could be really a tough battle to win. I would say that tool material that I used earlier, yeah. I talked about earlier, putting something over those plants, especially if they're ones that don't need cross-pollination, and securing it as best you can. And doing this early in the season so that the chipmunks don't think there's anything good to eat under there. Once they've figured out there's something good to eat, they're going to go to extraordinary measures to get it. But if they just think it's, there's some netting here, I'll go over there and eat, then they tend to leave things alone. So trying something like that, burying it down in the soil a little bit, covering the plant completely, that might help.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Green thumb or not, we do not discriminate on our gardening shows, and no question is a dumb one. If you're asking it or thinking it, there are 100 more people who are wondering the same thing. Charlie, we spent a lot of time on pests, so let's go positive now and start talking about planting for the fall. So when can people start planting for the fall?
Right now.
Oh, yeah.
Well, maybe not today, since it's going to be in the 90s today. They're probably not a good day to plant. But once this recent heat wave kind of passes, this is a great time to plant a lot of different things. And what I've noticed over the last bunch of years is that we're getting longer and longer falls, where if you are planting things that can take a light frost somewhere in October or so, sometimes you'll be able to go into November, December, depending on where you are in the state, growing things, and they grow really well. But the key is to get started now in early August, because you're going to need to get plants up to a certain height so that by September, October, they're going to be mature enough that you can actually start harvesting them and using them. The problem isn't so much that the cold weather comes in September, October. It's the short days. That slows down the plant growth. So a lot of times people will have little seedlings and they'll just kind of sit there in September, October because they haven't gotten enough growth on them early. So right now you can be starting to look at planting root crops like carrots, beets, radishes, peas you can try, especially if you're in the Champlain Valley, Connecticut River Valley, places that are a little warmer in the state. You can get a nice crop of snow peas by the fall. And of course, all the greens. So the lettuces, Swiss chard, kale, arugula, all those kinds of plants you can plant in succession, actually, is what I usually recommend. Don't just plant a big row of it, but every week plant a little section, maybe a 1 foot row section. And if you do it that way, that's how you'll start harvesting it come September, October.
And Diane from Walpole, New Hampshire wants to know more. Diane, go right ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Charlie. I think that you have helped me so much over the years. So I actually was wondering specifically veggies that you like to plant this time of year. I know you mentioned lettuce and arugula and carrots and root crops. Are there any others?
No, those are usually the ones I kind of focus on this time of year. You know, I try to stage the garden in such a way that I have fall maturing crops like leeks, for example, ones that are long season crops, or Brussels sprouts, so that those I don't really do anything with. And in fact, even the kale that I planted in earlier this year, I haven't touched all summer. And now it's turning into a little kale forest, which is what I want. I want to have a real big mature plant come September, October, because I know it's not going to grow much more. But if it's there, it's kind of like having it in your outdoor refrigerator. It's just kind of there. You eat it as you need it, and it stays fresh because it's alive. So those leafy green crops and the root crops are two of the ones that I really look at. I've tried doing like fall cauliflower, but there's an insect pest, not to go back to pests, called the Swede midge. It's been a bit of a problem trying to get those to mature.
It's hard to lay off the pests.
I know.
All right, let's talk to Ken. He's calling us from Salisbury. Ken, go right ahead with your question.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. My wife called me to say Charlie was on Vermont Edition again, and it's like Christmas. You're like my funeral care.
Thank you.
Commissioner, so thank you. I like to specialize in pumpkins, grow them as big as I can. And I've been afflicted, some years ago it wasn't a problem, but I've been afflicted lately with powdery mildew. This year I'm able to fight it off, it seems like, with a mixture of whole milk and neem oil. So whenever I see it, I attack it. And I'm kind of staying ahead of the game. But I think whenever a plant gets weakened, it starts to mature and turn orange. So I get a big percentage of my pumpkin crop stops getting bigger and is ready to pick like middle of August. And I'd like to do, I don't know if there's anything I can do about that.
Well, in the future, what you can do is plant a little bit later. You know, a lot of the pumpkin growers who grow them for Halloween, which is like the big pumpkin time, anytime mid-October to Halloween time, they're often planting their pumpkins like in June, maybe even early July. Because what happens is that they can stage it so that those pumpkins will be maturing later in the year. So they're not turning orange now. Now you got to hold on to them for a couple months if you're going to.
Or schedule Halloween early.
Or move Halloween to the end of August. That would work too.
Yes.
So as far as the powdery mildew goes, that's one great solution using neem oil. It's a nice product that works. There's another product called Serenade. It's a bacteria, Bacillus subtilis, that's available that works well. And then, of course, there's the baking soda sprays that have been used either the home remedy version of those or as a commercial version too. All of those are great as preventive measures. They're not going to really do much to a powdery mildew outbreak that's taken over. But if you start seeing, just like you're talking about, a few signs of it here and there, spraying not just those signs but the whole plant with it is a good way to prevent it from spreading. The powdery mildew, you'll start seeing more and more of it as it gets cooler in the nights when you get those dewy mornings. That moisture is there, and that's where the powdery mildew gets started.
Let's read this one from Jim. He says, our tomato plants are still flowering and our tomatoes are green. Should we prune back the tops at this time?
No, it's only early August. Be patient,
relax,
Jim. Patient, Jim. Yeah, this is the time of year everyone's like, oh, they're never going to mature. It's August 6th. We've got a lot of time.
A little more zen there, Jim.
So, yeah, if this was early September and we were talking about it, I'd say yes, definitely prune back the tips of those tomatoes, prune back the flowers that are forming because you're not going to have enough time for those flowers to set and form mature. Your fruit. But this time of year, you're going to have such a big tomato crop, you're going to be begging people to take it away.
Let's go to Jim's place. All right. So I'm going to keep us off pests for a while. We got this email from Anne. Can you share some tips on making window boxes for flowers? Is there the best kind of wood, best ways to provide drainage, or anything else you think is important?
Yeah. So if you want to make your own out of wood, certainly you want to get rot-resistant wood like cedars and hemlocks. That's usually the best wood. Depending upon how big you're making these window boxes and how it's going to look on your house, if it still looks okay, I would go with thicker wood too, not just a 1-inch thick, but maybe 1.5 or 2-inch thick wood. Again, the whole idea is that it's going to last longer. Once you have your box design, and you can go online and just Google window boxes, you know, DIY, and you probably can find all kinds of designs. But once you've chosen your box design, you put it together, make sure it has drainage holes. So drill a bunch of different drainage holes in the bottom of that box so the water will pour out, and then figure out how you're going to fix that box to the window, whether it be some hardware you want to attach to the back of it. Just kind of think about how it's going to reside and be able to be stable on that window. And that's pretty much all you really need to do if you're making your own window box. You can take that window box too and put a liner in it. So if you want it to last longer, you can build your window box to the size of some of these plastic boxes that you see out there, then put the plastic box inside the wooden box, and the plastic box will help preserve that wood longer, but you won't see it because it's kind of embedded in the wooden box.
Oh, wow. That's brilliant. We heard from Donald in Shelburne who emailed, our Wake Robin Care community has a large area of raised bed garden plots for use by the residents. This season, for the first time, squirrels and possibly deer are eating much of the tomato crop. Can you recommend any measures to prevent this loss? Fencing is not practical.
Yeah. So again, like I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of these animals are looking for moisture and they see these luscious tomatoes. So they're going to go looking for them. The deer will be, believe it or not, easier to control than the squirrels. So there are a number of different things. It sounds like fencing is not an option. So we'll talk about repellent sprays. So there's a number of different repellent sprays you can use. You can get ones that are home remedies like the Dial soap things or the Irish Spring soap, I think it was. Human hair in bags hung around. Animal urines, you know, coyote urine, bobcat urine, spraying those around. They'll work to a certain degree. There are commercial products that have rotten eggs in them, that have cayenne pepper, garlic, and the one I use that seems to be most effective is one called Plant Skid, S-K-Y-D-D. Mm. Skid means protection in Swedish. And this is a product they've used in Sweden for to keep deer away from trees and other plants, and it's been very effective. It smells horrible when you put it on. It is blood meal slaughterhouse waste. So it's not going to make this any prettier than it is.
Forget about lunch.
But the smell dissipates for humans pretty quickly.
Oh, okay.
So after an hour or so, you don't even smell it anymore. But the deer continue to smell it, so much so that it'll last 3 months. So that might be one product that you might want to try. Maybe not spray it right on the fruit. Keep it on the leaves or maybe an area around the plants and see if that would keep them away.
All right. Now, Charlie from Saratoga Springs, New York, wants to weigh in back in on voles and chipmunks. So, Charlie, you're on with Charlie. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
All right. I have an organic vegetable garden, and I've had problems with voles and with chipmunks and with squirrels, and the fence took care of a squirrel, a little three-foot fence took care of the squirrels.
Mm-hmm.
But when I see signs of voles in my garden, every spring I take some of the garlic scapes that I have on my garlic plant, I put them in a blender with water, and I make a concentrate of garlic, and I put them in plastic bags, throw them in my freezer.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I see signs of voles, I either use a hose sprinkler or a sprinkler can. And I dilute the concentrated garlic water, and it gets rid of them in a few days. They don't like
wow.
it. They move on. I sprinkle the whole garden with it. And
so,
that, for me, works every year.
Love that.
That's great. Yeah, so the key is the really concentrated garlic. That's that's important.
The key is also to be named Charlie, and then you know all this stuff, as I'm finding
well,
out.
Well, thank you very much for your tip, Charlie.
All right, let's take another one from Jeff in Lake George. Hey, Jeff, go right ahead.
Hi. I planted some bulbo hydrangeas just recently for a wedding in our yard. And I inadvertently had used some fertilizer for azaleas, and it they haven't really perked up real well. I wonder if there's anything I can do to kind of offset that.
Yeah, so unless you used a lot of the azalea fertilizer, I don't think that should harm them so much. You know, as long as when you planted the bobo hydrangea, because they do actually like a little bit of an acidic soil. So you use some compost or worked in the compost into the native soil, and you've been watering it well. The bobo is more of a late maturing hydrangea, a panicle hydrangea. So if you don't see flowers yet, you'll see them pretty soon as they start coming along. So I think just keep it watered, and hopefully it'll be blooming in time for the wedding.
So like Jim, be patient.
Yes.
Be patient, grasshopper. Okay. So there is something called deadheading flowers, and it sounds a lot like this is a Mitch Wertleib thing, but it has nothing to do with the Grateful Dead. So what is deadheading flowers all about?
So deadheading flowers is just like it sounds. When those flowers die, you want to remove them from your plant. There are a number of annuals that are what we call self-cleaning, meaning that they'll just drop those flowers and continue to flower. But perennials and some other annual flowers don't do that. So if you can do that, that will extend the flowering season. That'll stimulate the plant to start producing more flowers so you can get them keep coming and coming and coming. So as you're seeing things like canna lilies, for example, in this heat, starting to send up flower stalks, as soon as those flower stalks start going by, cut them off and maybe you'll get another one coming up.
Mm.
So it's a way to really extend how many flowers you have.
Are there, I don't know, heat-loving varieties of flowers or summer bulbs, things like that?
Oh, yeah. So the canna lilies, for example, are something that really love the heat. Mendivia vines are another thing.
I'll say that again.
Mendivia vines.
There you go.
Yeah, maybe in Cuba we'll see some Mendivia vines. But yes, there are a number of different plants that we treat as annuals but love this hot temperature. So they really are exploding in this weather.
All right. And so what are you going to be doing the rest of the day out in the garden?
Well, I'm not going to be out in the garden because it's going to be in the 90s.
Oh, that's right.
But when it does cool down, I've planted some fall carrots. I'm planting cover crops, too. I just did that. I pulled out an area that was onions and put in a combination of fall peas and some oats as a cover crop. So that's another thing you can do. As you're removing plants, whether it be a flower garden or a vegetable garden, consider putting a cover crop in that'll just go right through the fall into the winter, and then you turn it under in the spring.
Beautiful. Horticulturist Charlie Nardozzi is the host of the Vermont Garden Journal. He's a gardening coach, and we have a link to his website on our show page at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Charlie, always great to have you back here. Thanks.
Always fun to be here. Thanks.